Welcome. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. In San Jose, U.S. District Judge Lucy Koh is considering approval of a $324 million settlement in a class action lawsuit brought against four big Silicon Valley companies. The lawsuit, filed on behalf of more than 60,000 employees, alleges that Apple, Google, Intel, and Adobe conspired to suppress wages by agreeing not to recruit each other's employees. The suit was filed in 2010 after a Department of Justice antitrust investigation discovered secret agreements and communications between top executives at the companies. Revelations included messages from Apple's Steve Jobs threatening war if Google continued to recruit engineers from Apple's Safari team. Past class actions in the tech world have led workers to organize and respond collectively to improve conditions. Later in the hour, we're going to talk to an organizer from one of them, WashTech, formed after a class action lawsuit against Microsoft, in which employees showed that they were wrongly categorized as independent contractors and therefore were denied benefits. But even as the New York Times has editorialized that the latest revelations provide evidence of white-collar wage theft, so far, the reaction among tech workers has been muted. So how do people in high tech respond to what these lawsuits have revealed? Will these new revelations lead dissatisfied workers to organize, to improve working conditions and cut a better deal? And why has high tech proven so averse to unions and other forms of worker organizing? If you work in high technology, we want to hear your perspective and your experience. You can call in at 866-798-TALK, 866-798-TALK. You can email feedback at yourcallradio.org or simply post a comment at yourcallradio.org, our website. And if you'd like to remain anonymous, we understand. We would love to have the view from inside this industry. So if you've got it, please bring it to the program. With us today to unfold what's been going on is Mark Ames, who has been writing extensively about the wage suppression scheme among the biggest tech companies. He's a senior editor at Pando Daily and has also been a contributor to The Nation and Alternet. He was founding editor of the defunct Moscow satirical magazine The Exile, which was closed down by the Kremlin in 2008. And he's also the author of Going Postal, Rage, Murder, and Rebellion, From Reagan's Workplaces to Clinton's Columbine. Mark, thank you so much for joining us today on Your Call.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
So you have been providing some fascinating coverage for Pando Daily of this latest lawsuit and also providing some context, really diving into the documents that have been revealed. And let's start with where the Department of Justice investigation that started a few years ago that kind of set off what then brought forward the information that's the basis of the, of this current lawsuit where there's this $324 million settlement being discussed. So start with the DOJ investigation.
Sure. So it seems that the DOJ investigation, I mean, they filed their complaint in the fall of 2010. It seems to have started in 2009, the antitrust division. The only thing that's surprising is why it didn't start earlier. The CEOs of these companies that organized and participated in this wage suppression, non-solicitation cartel, illegal and secret, they weren't always very secret about it. I mean, in 2007, for example, there's a really ugly exchange between Steve Jobs, who was the head of both Apple and Pixar, both of which were sort of almost charter members of this secret cartel, him threatening the CEO, the then CEO of Palm. Palm, you know, doesn't really exist anymore. It got swallowed up by HP. But at the time, Jobs basically said, you have two choices to the CEO. It's like a mobster almost. He says, you know, either you join our non-solicitation, no cold call agreement, because wages are getting out of control and everybody else is on board with this, or we'll ruin you with patent infringement lawsuits, frivolous patent infringement lawsuits. And Jobs openly says to the CEO of Palm, you don't have the resources to fight these lawsuits, frivolous or otherwise, so take your pick. And the CEO, one of the few people who stood up to Jobs and said, no, I'm not going to participate. A, it's illegal. B, it's unfair. And C, it's not in our interests. And, you know, look who won.
And when you look at the documents that you report on about this lawsuit that's now underway, Steve Jobs' role as someone really pushing this alleged collusion is very powerful.
Yeah, well, so let's go back to the beginning of
Please.
It. This actually began as a as an agreement between just two firms, which was Lucasfilm. It was really George Lucas who was the initiator of this, sort of the Obi-Wan Kenobi, as I call him, of this thing back in the mid-1980s. So when they spun off Pixar from Lucasfilm, Pixar was a specialized computer animation segment within Lucasfilm. It was spun off. It was essentially financed. The spinoff was financed by Steve Jobs right after he got fired by Apple in 1985. And at that time, Lucas and Ed Catmull, who was the head of Pixar, and Jobs, agreed not to poach each other's employees because Lucas said our margins are small. The employees are valuable because of their training. So let's agree nobody cold calls the other employees. Nobody bids up. They keep talking about bidding wars and bidding up their wages. And if one of our workers comes to your place or yours comes to mine, let's inform each other and not, you know, offer them jobs. And so that began at that point in the 86 or so. And over time, as we're learning from documents, I just wrote about this yesterday for Panda Daily, this started to include other computer animation studios like DreamWorks Animation is all over. It appears that DreamWorks Animation was also part of this agreement. Sony Pictures at one point appears to have agreed and then not followed through and then been punished, and other small computer animation firms. Now let's skip ahead to 2005. This is when the latest tech boom really started exploding again after the crash in 2000. 2005, tech is booming again. The Google IPO is helping fuel a huge influx of money. And so what's happening is, for the first time in a while, wages for computer specialists, engineers, programmers, and so on are starting to soar levels that hadn't been seen in the Valley in probably a decade at least. And so Jobs rings up the heads of Google, and they're a little bit starstruck and seem to be a bit more easily bullied at this time, and basically says, I've heard that your people are trying to recruit my people. This is driving up wages. Either you agree to stop doing this and we enter an agreement similar to the one that already Pixar had with Lucasfilm, or we go to all-out war. And so Eric Schmidt and Sergey Brin immediately cave. And on top of it, remember, all these companies, they have these incestuous boards of directors relationships. So they wind up developing, I hate to use, for lack of a better word, sort of almost emotional relationships with each other in a way that they don't for their own employees. And so they don't want to offend each other. They want to work with each other, and their interests ultimately coincide. They don't want their labor costs going up.
Well, in responding to your reporting and to also this lawsuit more broadly, some people inside of high tech have said, a lot of these agreements are about kind of stopping disruptive poaching, where just for the sake of saying, okay, well, you go across the street basically to say, here's a high-level person, a very talented person on the other side in a competing company, and you try to recruit them not simply because you want their talent on your side of things, but because they play a key role in projects that would help you to disrupt.
Sometimes it is, but again, what we know from the emails, from the private emails, is that the primary driver of this was it coincided exactly with the boom in wages. We have emails from Meg Whitman when she was the head of eBay to Eric Schmidt saying, the whole talk of the Valley is Google is driving up wages, and all of our labor costs are too high. We have Lucas saying this in private emails. We have Catmull saying this. We have all of these guys saying this. So that's the primary driver. The problem of poaching talent with specialized knowledge has always been a problem. But what happened in 2005 was specific to soaring labor costs. We also know that when Google then tried to strong-arm Facebook into joining this secret collusion, the secret cartel or agreement, Facebook said no. And literally 1 month after the DOJ started to investigate Google, Google obviously backed out of all of its non-solicitation agreements with all the other tech firms, and within 1 month immediately announced a 10% hike in everybody's pay all across the board.
That's Mark Ames. He is a senior editor at Pando Daily, and he has been writing extensively about the lawsuit around wage suppression at some of the Silicon Valley's top companies. And we want to invite you, if you are someone who works in high tech and you've been following this story or just listening to what Mark Ames is talking about, the practices at the top level of these companies that are obviously front page news all the time, these names that we know well, hearing about them emailing back and forth about how can we not compete for one another, another's employees and thereby keep wages low. The number to call is 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment at our website, yourcallradio.org. I'd love to hear if you are someone who has worked at Google, Adobe, Intel, these companies that are very important here in Northern California, and you have some perspective on this, or maybe you've worked in other high-tech companies and you think, oh, well, here's my perspective on what may or may not have been going on at these companies. The number again, 866-798-8255. So, Mark, I wanted to ask you, I think a lot of people who are outside of these companies, their image of people working inside of them is, you know, these may be really people who are worked really hard, but generally they're well paid. They have high prestige jobs relatively, and that, you know, maybe their wages might have been affected a little bit by this, but, you know, this isn't really anybody else's problem but people within this company. Why would you say this is a story that people outside of these companies should care about?
Because this is a political issue, ultimately. It's a political issue and a political problem that affects everyone. And so what we see, all across the board in this economy, what's happened in the last 30 years, we've reached a point where even supposedly the best compensated industry workforce, or, you know, the best treated supposedly industry workforce, which would be, you know, tech industry, Silicon Valley, even they don't have control over their fates, their lives, and even they are having their wages ripped off. Now, let's remember, there's a lot of wage money ripped off here. I mean, otherwise, these CEOs and board directors and so on would not have agreed, to do something that they knew was illegal. Again, this comes out in emails. They knew what they were doing was illegal. They tried to make sure that it didn't leak out. What they wanted to do was pad their earnings, make sure that labor costs didn't cut into their profits, and they did that by stealing their workers' wages. Now, granted, stealing from a minimum wage workers or a low income workers' wages hurts a lot more. I mean, you see that, and it gets you obviously more riled up, more angry. It's more shocking. These people can't even, are barely trying to feed their families, can't afford health insurance, and so on and so forth. So, obviously, in terms of pathos, when those people have their wages stolen, it is more serious. We all know that. But politically, this is all part of one process, and that process is the concentration of power and wealth, the concentration of power in corporations, and this is happening in Silicon Valley despite all of the, you know, cant about free markets and competition and so on. What we're seeing is our corners of the tech industry being increasingly monopolized, and with that monopoly power, the rest of us, even upper income people, lose power over their lives, have their wages stolen. And we were lucky that Jobs was such a nutcake about all this that, you know, that the cover was blown. I mean, how many other times has this happened that we don't even know about?
And the result of the Department of Justice investigation was that these companies, the four who are named in this lawsuit, agreed no longer to do this kind of not competing for one another's employees, right?
Yes, they, seven companies, including Pixar and Lucasfilm and Intuit. They're all enjoined. The executives of these companies and the people named, they're all enjoined under penalty of potential jail time to abide by the Sherman Antitrust Act laws and the Clayton Antitrust Act laws, and to report regularly, like every, I'd have to go back again, like every 6 months or every year or something. They have to constantly report and show and demonstrate how they're complying with antitrust law.
So, Mark, I want to bring in someone else with some perspective on this. That's Danielle von Jaarsveld. She's a professor at the Sauder School of Business at the University of British Columbia, and she has researched the changing nature of work and employment in information technology. Professor von Jaarsveld, welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
Danielle, I'm not hearing you very well. Go ahead. Let's try again.
Hi, can you hear me?
Great. Thank you so much for joining us. Really appreciate it. So I know you've been following this case somewhat, and you've been listening to Mark Ames kind of laying out what's been revealed and his story of how he sees it fitting into a longer-term pattern in high technology and the way it deals with workers. What context would you put it in, and what are the challenges for workers, you know, beyond class action lawsuits trying to organize on behalf of their interests in the high-tech world?
Yeah, you know, I think he's making some great points. You know, I think historically the Silicon Valley workforce has been characterized as engaging in a lot of job hopping, a lot of mobility, and that gives them a fair amount of power to negotiate their compensation, the terms of their employment. But you know, these anti-poaching practices depress that, and then that in turn can depress compensation and really affects the labor market. You know, I think the question is, are there longer-term solutions beyond these class action lawsuits that can help support the tech workforce?
What has made it difficult to take those actions other than the lawsuits? What are some of the real challenges around that?
Well, you know, I think some of what Mark has been touching on, you know, this the impression that the tech workforce has very good working conditions masks a lot of the diversity within the composition of the technology workforce. You know, they're beyond full-time employees. You have a lot of people who are on contingent or non-standard employment contracts, and they have a very different reality in working for technology companies than a lot of their full-time counterparts. And, you know, so the question becomes, as these employment relationships become more diverse, what types of models can emerge in order to provide employees with representation to ensure the fairness of their employment conditions?
Professor von Jaarsveld, I want to invite people who are in our audience, and we know we have a lot of people in Silicon Valley and in the tech industry who are in our listening area. If you'd like to join the conversation here on Your Call, the number to join us is 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. Or you can post a comment at yourcallradio.org. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and today we are talking about the implications of recent lawsuits and investigations that allege Apple, Google, Intel, Adobe, and other major high-tech companies conspired to suppress employee wages. Talking about what does this say about what it means to work in the high-tech industry, how workers are thought about and treated by employers, and what options there are for organizing for workers in high-tech. We'd love to have you join the conversation, whether you're in the industry or just interested in questions of wage suppression, wage theft, worker organizing. 866-798-8255. And actually, I want to go to one of our callers who's asked to remain anonymous. Welcome to the program. You're on the air. Go ahead.
I agree that non-compete has been a factor in controlling wages. I'm a longtime Silicon Valley engineer. I work in a niche area. But there are other things that are being used to control wages. I actually at one point worked in a startup that was acquired by Intel. So I have seen quite closely what some of the techniques that the larger companies use. One of them is a kind of cyclic routine layoffs. Mm-hmm. Most large companies once a year, will have a blanket layoff where they take out maybe 5% of their workforce. And what that accomplishes is they will do it in a kind of across-the-board way, so they cannot be sued, and they'll claim that it's for fiscal reasons. So that's a way to, often the people that are taken out are workers that do speak out about some of these issues. A lot of them are women, actually. Recently, it's been pointed out that there is the employment of women in the technology workforce is very low. And that is one of the ways that this happens. It's not, I don't think it's systematic, but I think women are women with children especially are often viewed as less productive. And in these blanket layoffs, I've noticed that women are disproportionately removed from the workforce. And I will frankly say that another factor is the H-1B visa. Mm-hmm. The H-1B visa is used to hire workers less than 35 years old, and very frequently these workers are men. And that's been in the press, that these H-1B workers that are brought in are often less than 35, and they're almost, I would say, 90% of them are men.
Well, thank you
so
for
the women, women and older workers are being removed from the workforce, partly because they're viewed as being having family responsibilities, but also because they're probably more likely to speak out about some of these issues. Thank you.
Thank you so much for calling in, Professor Van Jaarsveld.
Yeah, I think the callers bring up some very important issues around diversity, gender, and H-1B visas. I think that finding ways to increase the diversity of the technology workforce is really important. And there's a lot of research showing that a more diverse workforce is more productive. But using layoffs to target people who are speaking out, that can really negatively affect the willingness of people to, challenge and bring up these particular issues.
Actually, I wanted to bring in Mark Ames. I mean, as you've been reporting on this, I mean, you've really been one of the leading people writing on this particular settlement and these issues of wage suppression in high tech. What are you hearing from people inside the industry, the people, the kind of folks who would be party to a lawsuit like this?
I'm hearing mostly anger, other people saying they thought something like this has been going on for a while. But I think just a lot of anger and disillusionment, I would say. And oddly enough, even from some people in the investor class, a lot of anger because, if all these big companies that have their sort of oligopoly positions agree not to poach from each other. Well, what happened was, from what I've heard anecdotally, is I've heard this actually from several good sources, is that they would then poach all of these startups, and that stifles innovation, which is Silicon Valley's entire credo, right? So because they can't poach from each other, they all basically go in and raid and gut startups just as they're potentially getting somewhere, and that also then helps the monopolists and those in strong positions maintain their strong positions as well. I mean, again, I think a lot of this is it's kind of a classic robber baron capitalism, monopoly capitalism.
Mark Ames, I'm going to stop you right there because we have to go to a break. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar here on Your Call. That's Mark Ames from Pando Daily. Also with us, Professor Daniel Van Jaarsveld at the University of British Columbia. We'll be back in just a moment to talk more about wage suppression in the high-tech industry.
This is Local Public Radio, KALW, San Francisco. You know, if you're buying or selling a home, there's a new way you can make sure you're working with the best agent in your area and providing significant support to Local Public Radio. KALW is partnering with My Broker Donates, a service that connects home buyers and sellers with the most effective agents in their area, helping you get the house result you want while at the same time generating a donation to Local Public Radio. You can learn more at kalw.org/mybrokerdonates. That's kalw.org/mybrokerdonates.
For those of you joining us now, we are talking about allegations of wage suppression in high tech, a recent lawsuit that has a potential $300 million settlement that shows that Apple, Google, Intel, and Adobe conspired to suppress employee wages, talking about how high tech workers are or not responding to this issue, to these revelations. And we'd appreciate you joining the conversation at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org, or better yet, leave a comment at yourcallradio.org. And we did have a caller before the break who decided to remain anonymous. We certainly welcome you if you can give us an inside perspective from some of these companies we're talking about or this industry. We understand that sometimes better to just kind of call in and give your perspective without giving your name. The number again, once again, is 866-798-8255. With us on the line are Mark Ames, who has been covering this for Pando Daily, and Professor Danielle von Jaarsveld, a professor at the Souder School of Business at the University of British Columbia, who deals with issues of work and productivity in information technology. We've got full lines, and I want to go to folks in just a moment. But I did want to ask you, Professor von Jaarsveld, this question of kind of turnover in high tech. And of course, there's the question, what we're hearing from our caller about, you know, kind of laying everybody off to rehire them and kind of keeping people in this insecure position.
Right.
But also just the fact that, you know, when, you know, in 2005, when this, you know, this lawsuit that we're now talking about, you know, when the action was happening, there's been a lot of change in, you know, the folks that those, you know, that group of companies might have agreed we're not going to try to hire away each other's folks. But, you know, Facebook and Twitter were barely getting going at that point, and now those are, you know, places where those same people would be jumping to. Is there just, I mean, how does that affect kind of the status of workers, their ability to bargain and get what they want? And, you know, and does it in some ways give some advantages to workers? You know, there's always some new player that they can say, I'll take my talents over here.
Right. I think it hugely affects employees and their ability to access opportunities in the labor market. The fact that there is this anti-poaching agreement is basically reducing the compensation packages for employees and reducing their ability to negotiate their employment contracts. And, you know, given that Silicon Valley has really been premised on a lot of mobility, it really runs counter to that.
Well, I want to bring in a couple of callers who've gotten in touch. First, let's go to Andy in Redwood City. Andy, welcome to your call. Andy, are you with us?
Say that corporate governance in Silicon Valley is really in a bad shape. It's incestuous. There's conflicts of interest all over the place. Carl Icahn has brought up in the public about Mark Andreessen over at eBay and the deals he does, even though he's on the board. He's doing deals directly with eBay where he has insider information that nobody else has, and just as an example. And the accountability just isn't there at the board level. There is no accountability in Silicon Valley because of the conflicts of interest. And we need a system more like the German system, a supervisory board system. If you actually had employees of the company on the corporate board, you wouldn't see a lot of these things happening. You wouldn't see labor treated so poorly in the Valley.
Mark Ames, you've talked about some of these issues. What do you think?
Yeah, I think it's a great point about having employee representatives on boards and his larger point about the conflicts of interest on the boards of directors of these companies. I think it's a huge problem. And if I have my acts correct, the professor might be able to help me with this. I think it was the Clayton Antitrust Act that was supposed to outlaw boards of directors being, having people that have conflicts of interest on it. And I think it was the Reagan administration, towards the end of the Reagan administration, I mean, a lot of anti-monopoly law and regulations were basically gutted under Reagan, despite a long history in this country of anti-monopoly politics and sentiment and so on. I mean, pretty much going back to the founding of this country. It was gutted under Reagan. It was gutted further under Clinton, and that's just gone on and on. So nobody calls out these conflicts of interest on boards of directors anymore. I mean, it's got to be beyond way, way, way over the top to even raise an eyebrow, and that's unfortunate. So if you ask me, I mean, we keep getting back to what can be done. I think it's just the same old things as always, organizing and politics. I don't see any other way.
Professor Van Jaarsveld, anything to add there?
Yeah, you know, I think the caller's point about Germany, the involvement of works councils, representation from employees on boards is a really good one. You know, I think both in helping support companies during periods of difficult times, we've seen, you know, a lot of examples in Germany of employees making concessions to help companies survive economic downturns.
I want to bring, actually, speaking of organizing, I want to bring in Rennie Sawade. He's the communication chair of the Washington Alliance of Technology Workers, otherwise known as WashTech. And this is a union based in Washington State that represents high-tech workers. He's worked in high-tech as a software engineer for over 25 years and has seen some changes and also seen the challenges of organizing in high-tech. Rennie, thank you so much for joining us.
Hi.
So talk about, so you actually WashTech itself kind of came out of a time when there were some legal challenges to practices in high technology, and particularly at Microsoft. Talk a little bit about what was happening and why workers were responding and organizing at that time.
Well, it started in 1997 with some temporary workers at Microsoft. They were noticing, even at that time, things like stagnant wages, and they didn't, you know, didn't get the benefits that the other Microsoft full-time employees would get. They were basically treated like second-class citizens within the organization. They got together, and they formed WashTech, which was chartered in 1998. And they did, for a time, they did organize the contract workers there, but they had a lot of difficulty with that because Microsoft didn't recognize the union. Because it was formed of contractors, they said, well, they didn't have any legal obligation to, you know, do any contract negotiation with them at all because they were as part of a separate company. So in the long run, I mean, that wasn't successful, and it ended up falling apart there. WashTech also tried to organize Amazon, or some call center workers at Amazon, which is headquartered here in Seattle. And that wasn't successful either, because what Amazon did was during the organizing process, they essentially just offshored that call center to another country. And so, that put into that effort.
So you, just in the work in WashTech, have really seen the challenges of straight-up union organizing within these companies. But I understand you've done some other things to try to help workers kind of organize one another short of becoming union.
Right. After those two problems, WashTech began what they call their at-large membership. And we still do that today. And what it is you can join WashTech as a member. So you're not part of any bargaining unit, but for like $11 a month, you can join as a member, and you can actually get some union benefits, and there's some free training stuff you can get, and free access to lynda.com, things of that nature. So when you join, you kind of help WashTech in its advocacy for tech workers. Because other things that we do besides just, you know, organizing is we do advocate for tech workers. We help to elect politicians that are union-friendly. And when we're also involved in promoting tech worker issues on the political side of things.
And if you want to find out more about WashTech or get in touch, we have a link to their website at our website, yourcallradio.org. I want to bring some callers who have gotten in touch into the conversation. Kim, who's given us a ring from Washington, D.C. Kim, good to have you with us on Your Call.
Sorry, one moment. I have you on speaker. I just wanted to register my disgust with these CEOs who were at the time pulling in record-setting bonuses, as everyone is probably aware, CEO pay has exploded over the past few decades, that as they were collecting record-setting payments, they were conspiring to suppress wages of their employees who were, let's face it, were maybe making six figures, but nowhere near in the realm of what these CEOs were pulling in. Thank you. I'll take my comment off the air.
Kim, thanks so much for that call. And actually, before we get response from our guests, I want to bring in Bob in Palo Alto. Bob, welcome to the program.
Hello. I worked in Silicon Valley for decades, and I think there's probably no mobile workforce in the world. People go, have always for decades, long before this incident changed companies, almost at the drop of a hat. It was kind of a joke, a standing joke in Silicon Valley that you could change jobs without having to change parking lots, just go across the way to the next company. So I think that this is probably a lot to do about nothing, though I don't approve of it. But you asked at the beginning, why are people in Silicon Valley not organizing? You used the word organizing. And to most people that means unions, but you didn't use the word unions because that has a lot of pejorative connotations, and you're a very liberal radio station. So I'd like to know, what did you mean by organizing? What did you have in mind when you used that word?
Well, I think there's a range of ways to organize. Obviously, for instance, a class action lawsuit is in itself a form of organization to challenge what happens in the companies. But I think that also what Rennie was just talking about with WashTec doing, organizing to advocate for workers, would be another example. And I know that, Professor von Jaarsveld, you might talk about some alternatives to union organizing that high-tech workers have contemplated or taken part in.
Yeah, I think what your caller is touching on, and I think it's an important topic, is this issue of organizing through collective action. I think that WashTec has really devoted a lot of energy to that and seen some successes through that. I think class action lawsuits, I think that represents another avenue for employees to focus attention on employment-related issues. We've also seen some other organizations, advocacy organizations arising, such as the Freelancers Union and professional associations, to help support people in the labor market if they're experiencing some uncertainty.
Talk about when people hear Freelancers Union, that can sound contradictory in their minds. What do they do?
So the Freelancers Union provides access to benefits, access to health insurance, those types of services that traditionally would be provided through a company, that in cases where when people aren't working, right, because they're freelancers, or have the type of employment status where they're not necessarily full-time employees, an organization like this would step in to provide those types of benefits.
And I'd like to invite listeners, if you work in high tech, we heard from Bob, who was talking about, hey, there's just so much mobility. People move from one company to the next that to be concerned about, how are workers being treated in that sense, that they have more kind of mobility, more opportunities than they would in most any other industries. Is that in any other industry? Is that your experience? And do you think Bob's right that maybe this is much ado about nothing to be talking about these non-poaching agreements that are coming forward? Or maybe it's a marginal example. It's not that important to your reality working in the industry. The number to call is 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or post a comment at our website, yourcallradio.org. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. And Mark Ames, I just wanted to turn that question about mobility to you. I mean, these latest revelations are really about non-poaching agreements where there's companies who are reaching out, doing cold calls to people at other companies to try to recruit them to come over to them. I mean, aren't there other ways that, workers become aware of opportunities beyond those kind of cold calling things that happen, that make it possible for them to do that?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, an important one that came up in the class action and in the Department of Justice antitrust suit. What they found, what we know from internal documents, from depositions, so on, from the tech companies, is that recruiters in the tech industry, and perhaps this is everywhere, but certainly in the tech industry, prioritize well above all other potential recruits those who are not looking for jobs, those who are found through cold call recruiting. They generally categorize those who are looking for a job and who come to them with a resume as the lowest quality employees, and they have all these, you know, recruitment agencies that have done studies that have quote unquote proven that. And so so actually this is what how the recruiters and the HR departments of all the tech companies themselves believe that, you know, this is how they think they find the best talent, is through cold calling. And also, you know, don't forget, when you suppress cold calling, you're suppressing information, essentially, in the labor market. So if people suddenly aren't getting called the way that they would, because a whole bunch of companies, and it wasn't just these seven. So remember, in Pando Daily, we reported numerous other companies were party to these agreements as well, to one degree or another, and some of them were also investigated by the DOJ, but were not put into the suits for various reasons. So we're talking actually about a lot of companies that were involved in this. When you're not getting cold calls into your, you know, your level or your department or so on, you don't know what you're worth. You don't know that people are even looking for you. So you don't even have the information to know that you're being underpaid. And if you, the more people you bring in, the more large companies you bring into this secret and illegal agreement, the less information there is out there. So you don't even know what you're worth.
Mark, let's bring in Jean in San Francisco. She has a question for the program. Jean, welcome to your call.
Hi. So we work with tech workers who are, you know, not usually considered tech workers, which is all the service workers on the big tech campuses, the janitors and the security officers. And the security officers work with very difficult working conditions, part-time work, a lot of unfairness on the job. So we have a website that we've developed called www.techcandobetter.org, and developers have actually reached out to us through the website, signing on to a letter to the judge calling on them to reject the settlement. So we're trying to build solidarity between, you know, service workers who work on the tech campuses as well as developers who are concerned about the wage-fixing lawsuit.
So, yeah, explain, talk about, because you're trying to build a bridge there that, that you kind of see don't existing right now in terms of these different workers in different parts of high tech.
Right.
And so the, and so when you say that you have a petition going to object to the settlement, talk about what the objections are about.
Well, you know, really that it's, you know, pennies on the dollar. It's, you know, grossly inadequate. It really doesn't achieve justice for developers in terms of, you know, the amount of money that is, that tech companies are saving versus, you know, what the employees are due. So that, you know, that's the objection that developers have signed on to on, with our petition on our website. And then, you know, separate from that, the security officers are organizing to demand fairness on the job, full-time work. You know, this is sort of the other face of the tech worker, right, is all the security and the other service workers who are struggling to make ends meet as the cost of living in the Bay Area is kind of going through the roof, as we all know.
Well, Jean, thank you so much for calling up, and we will post that website, techcandobetter.org, at our website, yourcallradio.org. Mark Ames, any response to what Jean was talking about there?
I think I'm glad that that she called, and she's trying to build the most important bridge, really, which is the bridge between the lower income workers in the tech industry, the backbone, really, and the higher income, and the same political forces that they're both up against. I think that's, I mean, if there's any real way to readjust this alignment of power, that it's really the only way to do it is by kind of aligning, you know, the people who are victims of this overwhelming power at the very top.
And can you just outline for us the status of this settlement in this lawsuit against Apple, Google, Intel, and Adobe? Where is it at right now?
Yeah, so they had agreed to a settlement of $334 million in I think it was the very end of April, beginning of May, so it just before it went to trial. Clearly, the big tech companies were fearful of a trial happening and wanted to settle before more stuff came out and all this became public. And the judge, I should say, Lucy Koh, the judge, is a fascinating, really intense, really brilliant judge. So it is a shame from a journalist's point of view. It's definitely a shame that the lawsuit did not go ahead. And I think, you know, I share a lot of the frustrations. I also know from reporting on the politics and the way politics has affected the judicial system in the last 30 years, you know, that there's an argument to be made that because of the way that instructions are now set, thanks to precedent in the federal courts and so on, you know, there's no sure thing that the suit would have been won. So I think in favor of the lawyers, the plaintiff's lawyers, they did win an unprecedented, this has never happened before, or they did settle or appear to have settled, an unprecedented antitrust suit that involved fixing workers' wages. Now, was it enough money? I would say absolutely not. I completely agree with her. And, you know, I wish them luck.
Well,
I should just add real quickly. Yeah, so Judge Koh, one of the plaintiffs complained that the terms of the settlement were unfair. And Judge Koh, at the meeting where she reportedly would have approved of the settlement, instead she said that she had some serious doubts about the settlement figure. So we're still waiting for her to either approve it or to dink it and to go to trial.
We got one last call I'm going to try to bring in because we're short on time. But I want to go to our line once again to an anonymous caller. Welcome to your call.
Hi. I'd just like to address the comment that Silicon Valley workers are just walking across the parking lot and getting a job in another company, and that they can easily just jump around from company to company. So I happen to be in a circle of engineers who are from elite Ivy League universities, and the average time, if somebody is let go from a company for an elite engineer, it often takes them six months to find another job. So the notion, and that's from sort of top tier elite engineers to kind of middle tier engineers making, say, $80,000 a year. I'd also like to comment, there's a notion that engineers make an extraordinary amount of money. It should be noted that engineers actually spend about 10 years after high school in school. Most of these companies, Google, Apple, they all want PhDs from elite universities. So we're talking the cream of the crop. And ultimately, at least for elite engineers, the end game for this is that people are not going to work in Silicon Valley if they have one of these elite degrees. They're going to go and work somewhere else. And amongst my circle of friends, that's what they're thinking. They don't want their children to work in Silicon Valley.
Well, thank you. Thank you for the call. We appreciate you calling in. Professor Van Yarsveld, maybe you could talk a little bit about just what is the job market for people. Obviously, we're talking about a whole range of different both job classifications and levels of compensation. But, you know, your reaction to what our caller said.
Yeah, you know, I think that's a really good point. I think often there's this misconception that it's very easy to, you know, as the previous caller described, walk across the street and get another job. But I think what this anonymous caller is pointing out is a very important point. You know, that there can be, you know, time lags in how long it takes you to find a new opportunity that's going to fit for you, and what do you do during that six-month period. It might take you a little longer, and so during these periods of insecurity and uncertainty, how do you develop a sustainable career? And so, you know, I also think she's making a great point around the fact that it takes a lot of time, investment, and education to, you know, get to the level where you are one of these elite engineers, and these anti-poaching policies really depress their ability to be compensated fairly for their investment in their education. And I agree. I think that's really problematic.
Randy Soweto, I want to give you the last thought. If you could be brief in responding to kind of just what being a worker in this area, what's perception, what's reality?
Well, I have to agree with the last caller. It takes months, and the whole recruiting process, I consider it pretty much dysfunctional. And I think when a lot of the recruiting went to being online, resume keyword searches, and getting tons of resumes submitted, electronically, it has made it very difficult to land that next job, and it generates a lot of fear over job security, which is one of our major issues as far as trying to get people organized.
Well, Renny Sawade with the Washington Alliance of Technology Workers, I want to thank you so much for joining the conversation and being with us. Really appreciate it. And I also want to thank our other guests, Daniel von Jarsfeld, who's a professor at the Sauder School of Business at the University of British Columbia, and Mark Ames, senior editor at Pando Daily. Thank you to all of you for joining this conversation today on Your Call.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we will be putting up links to all the organizations and information at our website, yourcallradio.org. You can also continue the conversation there, posting your comments. Thanks to everyone who called and as well. Sorry we couldn't get to all of them. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. This is Your Call. What's the legacy of the drug war? On the next Your Call, we'll revisit Rose Aguilar's conversation with Eugene Jarecki, filmmaker behind the documentary The House I Live In, which captures heart-wrenching stories from individuals at all levels of America's war on drugs. The drug war has lasted 40 years, cost $1 trillion, and led to over 45 million arrests. But what has it accomplished? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you.
Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.